Welcome to Oak City Church, a family of learners, lovers, and givers sent. For more information, visit us online at oakcitychurch.com. Let us know if we can help you in any way. Thank you for listening.
Mark 1, 21 through 28. And they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. And immediately there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent and come out of him." And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying out with a loud voice, came out of him. And they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, "What is this? A new teaching with authority. He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." And at once, his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding region of Galilee. This is the word of the Lord.
Good morning. Let me just say one more thing about the Gather 25. We were supposed to have a video this morning, but we just couldn't get it to work right. It is a we'll be probably at my house, it looks like, right now, and for a couple hours, and we'll be tuning in to a live thing from Dallas that's going to go for 25 hours on 7 continents. And so, like, Jenny Allen's goal was to get the whole world to pray together for the Lord to be at work. And so we're gathering with a whole bunch of other people. We'll be watching that, and we'll be praying, and we'll do that for 2 of the 25 hours. And you can tune on online if you want to. If you go to just search Gather 25, and you'll find it and be able to get the stream for it. But please consider being a part of that. So we are in a series in the book of Mark, the Gospel of Mark, and we titled it, "Who Do You Say That I Am?" Because it's the fundamental question in the middle of the gospel. And but in part because as I went through that, the Gospel of Mark, and just reading through it, it seems like Mark is saying over and over again, answering the question or asking it, "Who is Jesus?" and giving like a little bit of a different answer. It's like almost like a diamond with a bunch of different facets, and if you turn it just a little bit, then you see something a little bit different about it. And so that question, "Who is Jesus?" And today in this passage, Jesus is the one who has authority. Like, Jesus comes on the scene and they're like, "This is the man." Like, they get it immediately. So let me ask a question. This is a quick question. Have you ever met someone and quickly realized that they have, like, an authority, like that they really know what they're talking about? Yes. You have any examples? Ken Cantrell. Very nice. Is Ken here? Yeah. Oh, yes, people who think they know a little bit about everything. Yeah, there's just different people with different things. I took a new, went to a new level of cooking stuff and smoking stuff, and I smoked bacon this week, which, if you've been here for a minute, that's a big deal. I'm a big fan of bacon. And my authorities when it came to bacon were Kevin Tindall and Scott Brown, and I leaned heavily into those authorities this week, and they did not steer me wrong, you know? I was doing a contract thing a couple weeks ago, and so Isaac Vargas is a lawyer. I'm like, "Isaac, can you, like, just give me some advice, some authority," because he's an authority on that stuff. We've got a doctor in here. Justin is the doctor, and so my mom was having trouble, and he steered her to the right person. We have a number of people over the years, a weird number of people that do wastewater runoff stuff and are authorities in a realm where I didn't even know we needed authorities, but we have authorities, you know? And so we meet people from time to time that we think are, like, they have an authority. Usually it's in a realm, though, you know? Sometimes we meet people that seemed to have an authority in all the realms, but maybe we realized later that they didn't actually have authority, and we just kind of thought they did. Maybe they're super charismatic, and so they can come across that way, but not really be that. In this scene, they're going to realize that Jesus, who seems to be a somewhat unassuming, handle himself in a somewhat unassuming way, has an authority that is astonishing to them. So this is a little bit of his story. It's a narrative, and so I'm going to treat it as a narrative, just go through the story, and in stories, details matter. So I'm going to spend a few minutes on some details, some of which are relevant for today, but a few of which are going to be relevant for the next few months, just in this series. So this starts, they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching. So they go to Capernaum, immediately on the Sabbath, he enters the synagogue, and he was teaching. Capernaum is that's a real place, it's a town. It was like an active town for, 1,000 to 1,300 years. Now it's still there, you can go to Capernaum, but it is it's like an archaeological dig. It's on, if you see this map, it's on the north end. It's a little bit busy, but in that brown part, just beneath Galilee, it says Chorazin and Capernaum. And so you can see where it is. You go a few names down, and there's Nazareth, where Jesus is from. If you go all the way down into the Judea part, the orange part, you can see Jerusalem. And in the middle, you can see Samaria. So this is all going to be important. But you see at that northern part, there's Capernaum. It's right on that little blue Sea of Galilee, which I told you last week isn't little. It's 6 miles wide by 12 miles long. It's huge. And so this is it's a real place. It meant Kafer Nahum. That's what it was. It was the village of Nahum. So some dude named Nahum, they don't think it was the prophet, but it was his village. So sort of like Rollsville was a village that was named after a guy named Rolls. I don't know. Or Johnstown, like the cookies are really in the bottom shelf there, right? It's Johnstown. And Kafer Nahum was like that. It was a place. It was on a trade route called the Via Maris, which went from Egypt to Damascus. So that's a big deal, from Egypt to Damascus. And so it was not a huge place, but it was a significant place on this trade route. I mentioned last week that fish from the Sea of Galilee would be exported all over the Mediterranean, and that is in part how it happened, because they were on a major trade route. So he goes into this town, Capernaum. It's nearby where he grew up, immediately on the Sabbath. He enters the synagogue, and he was teaching. The synagogue is still there, kind of. So I have a few pictures of the synagogue, and so this is what's there now. And this is not the synagogue he would have been in. This was built like 300 years later. It's made of marble, and the one he was in would have been built of basalt, I think. I need an authority on rocks to tell me all that, but and this indicates that even a couple hundred years later, Capernaum had some wealth to the city, because you wouldn't build something out of marble if you didn't. They have an aerial view of this. You can kind of see what it looks like a little bit broader, like the different parts of the synagogue, because the synagogue is laid out very specifically. And then they had an image of like what it might look like if it was all put together. But Kevin, if you could go back to that first slide of it, and sit there for a second. I had a chance to go there a couple years ago, 15 years ago, and I don't think I was ready for it. Because you go there, and you read this passage, and you kind of think, like, no, that's no way. Like, this is impossible. Because you're not in the synagogue where he was, but the synagogue where he was is the underneath of this. It was built on the ruins of that synagogue. So you're in the exact same place where Jesus was teaching when this happened. And that does something to you. More impressive, a stone's throw from this, a couple blocks from this, is Simon Peter's house, the house where he goes just after this, and it'll be a scene next week, where he heals Simon Peter's mother-in-law. And so then you go down, and again, I wasn't ready for this trip. And so you see, like, these ruins, but then you see a platform on top of them. It's like a flat-bottom boat with a glass on the bottom of it. You go into this thing, and you can see through the glass, and you're looking down on that house where Peter's mother-in-law was healed, and then the whole city comes to him to be healed. And they know it because people had been worshiping there since the time of Jesus, and they like plastered over the walls, and they found graffiti on the walls that dates to the first century, and it's like Christian graffiti, like Jesus is Lord graffiti. And you realize that you're in the place where this stuff happened. And it will, like, it does something to you to know it's not just a story in a book, but it really happened in a physical place. You can go there. We can go there. I would go there today. If a friend of mine texted me right now on my computer and said, hey, we had a trip to Israel and one person dropped out, so we got one spot, but you need to be at the airport in 30 minutes. I'd be like, peace out, church. You guys figure it out. I'm going to Israel. Because that trip took everything that I had been reading for years and moved it, you know, down a layer. We can go there. A lot of you guys are at a place in life where you take pretty nice vacations, you know, and this is, it's not cheap vacation, but if you want to go there, let me know. And I know people who know people. I'll find a great guide. We'll go to Israel. This is pretty safe most of the time. We'll probably get back. And, but I mean, the northern part is safer, but it's pretty close to Lebanon. So, but you go there into these places and things just, if you watch The Chosen, like sometimes I'll watch that and think, oh, right, that's how that was. But this is like another layer of that. And so that just matters. It's a real place. It's still there, the physical space where this happened. He went into the space and he starts teaching. Now, let me say a few words about teaching. Teaching was just a huge deal to the Jewish people in this time and in this place. So I learned some stuff this week that has me thinking a little bit differently about it. I was listening to a guy teach on this, and he asked the question, did the exile work? Now, when I say exile, how many of you know, have an idea what I'm talking about when I talk about the exile, that period in the Old Testament? So I've used this the last few weeks, that I have a buddy who summed up the Old Testament as best I've heard it, that the Jewish people could not have screwed things up any worse than they did in the Old Testament. But then at the time of Jesus, they still expected a Messiah was going to come and God was going to rescue them, even though they'd screwed things up really bad. And in some ways, that is the gospel. Like, we have screwed things up really, really bad, but God loves us so much, he's still going to rescue us. And so in the Old Testament, God had taken them out of Egypt. He gave them the law on Mount Sinai. He gave them the land. He gave them the king that they wanted. And he's like, okay, go for it. Try and live out the kingdom, you know? And they could not do it. And so he starts telling them, like, you guys need to get your act together or I'm going to kick you out of the land just like I kicked the people out of the land to give you the land. And that is like the prophets in the Old Testament. So I was talking to someone last week who's reading through the Bible, and she said, I made it through Leviticus. And I feel like you should get a badge of merit when you make it through Leviticus, right? Because it's just, that's thick, it's hard. And she was into Numbers. And for me, the prophets are like kind of like that for me, because like I'm in my reading plan now. I'm about to hit Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel are like almost back to back to back. It's 160 chapters. It's a long time. And I don't feel great saying that as your pastor, but these are like the hard part for me because they seem so repetitive to me, because they are God, like when Israel is not getting it right, saying over and over and over again, like, if you guys don't get it together, I'm going to send you into exile. Like a parent at the mall who says to their kid, if you don't get your act together, I'm going to count to 10 and then you're in big trouble, mister, you know? And they get to 8 and everything's fine, but it's not working. And so then they slow down. They're like 8.5, 9. 9.5, and then we start doing fractions, right? 9 3/4, 9 7/8, 9 15/16, because they just don't want to do it. And that's how the prophets feel to me. But then God eventually sends them to Babylon, and that's their exile. They go to Babylon for about 70 years, and then they start to trickle back, and eventually they come back to kind of a ruined Jerusalem, you know, and then they're just waiting. And so his question was, did that work? And I was like, no, it didn't work, because they weren't ready for Jesus. And he said, actually, it kind of did work, because what happened in the exile is that they did learn a lesson, and the lesson they learned is that they didn't know the Bible. They didn't know the Old Testament that God had given them as well as they should have known it. So in Nehemiah, when they're coming back from exile, there's a scene where Ezra takes out the book of the law, and he reads it to the people, and all these people just start weeping because they realize they did not know the law of the Lord. They took for granted the word of God that he had given to them, and so they dedicated themselves to learn the book. And he said there was a renewed emphasis on that from the time of the exile forward, that they were determined not to take the Lord's word for granted, determined to know the rules. And So if you never thought about that before, think about it for a second, because it unlocks a little bit in the Gospels. So this was their misstep. They thought they didn't follow the rules because they didn't know the rules. That was their misstep. They thought they didn't follow the rules because they didn't know the rules. They thought if we'd known the rules, we would have followed the rules, and then we wouldn't have had all these problems. So let's know the rules, because if we know the rules, then we'll follow the rules. And in some way, that didn't help them, because while not knowing the rules was a problem, it was not their biggest problem. And thinking it was their biggest problem obscured their even bigger problem, which was what? Well, they could know the rules perfectly, right? What would be their problem then? They couldn't follow them even if they knew them. So they thought, well, if we know them, we can follow them. And this is the gospel, right? We need not someone not just to teach us what sin is. We need someone who can set us free from sin. And that's still the problem today. People are like, all religions are the same. They just teach you to be good, right? Because we all know the rules. We have a sense of morality. We have a general sense of right and wrong. We know what it is. The difference between Christianity and the rest of them is that the Christian faith says you're incapable of following the rules. Knowing the rules wasn't your problem. You're incapable of following them because of the power of sin. You don't need advice concerning the rules. You need good news that someone has set you free from the sin that's inside of you that makes you incapable of following them. And that is the gospel. Right? But the religious leaders in Jesus' day, they're not going to get that. And if you catch this, it starts to make sense the tension between Jesus and all the religious leaders. Because the storyline of the gospels is that tension that builds and builds and builds and builds. And so they decide, we have to get rid of this guy. But you can see that because they thought they were doing really good with the rules, because after the exile, they really focused in on following the rules, and Jesus comes along saying, actually, not so much, guys. You're kind of missing the point. And you see this throughout the scenes in the Gospels. And starting here, he goes into the synagogue to teach on the Sabbath. They had three levels of education. They were called Bet Sefer and Bet Talmud and Bet Midrash. So Bet Sefer was the house of the book. It was what little kids would go to until about the age of 10. It focused on the first five books of the Old Testament. They would memorize stuff because they didn't have access to it the way we do. They didn't have like seven Bibles in their house. They didn't have the storybook Bible. They didn't have all that stuff. And so they would memorize it. And a lot of kids came out of that first phase of education having memorized the first five books. They didn't just make it through Leviticus, they memorized it, you know? And then they would go to Bet Talmud, which is the house of learning, and that's from about 10 to 12. They'd move on to the writings and the prophets. They learned not just to memorize, but to interact and ask questions. About the age of 12, they would have their first Passover. It's what, you know, evolved into Bar Mitzvah age. And then they might move on to Bet Midrash, which is the house of study. And but not many of them did. At 12, a lot of them went into they didn't have it. They didn't move to that next phase. They went into whatever the family business was. And they were told to go home, you know, get into your family's trade, have a family, have kids, and pray that they get to Bet Midrash. Pray that they do better than you did. Because this was the honor in their culture, was to get to this point where you were the one that was just fluent in the words of God. And you knew not just how to recite it, but how to interact with it. And so Midrash, which was their form of commentary, was this big thing. And so it's just a huge deal. And it's all oral because they didn't have Bibles in their house. They had scrolls. And you know where the scrolls were kept for the community? In the synagogue. So he goes into the synagogue, but the synagogue is like everybody on the Sabbath would go into the synagogue and they would learn together. It's just what all of them did. It wasn't a question. It's super serious for them. The synagogue is like the next best thing to the temple. They had one temple. It's in Jerusalem. That's where God resides. It's where they bring the sacrifices. You didn't bring a sacrifice to a synagogue. But a synagogue, after the exile, they started to do synagogues because they were more spread out, and it's where they would come to learn together. It's a little bit like a church. And so they would go and worship, but they didn't have like a main person that would preach every week in the synagogue. The scribes from the town would do it, or occasionally they would have a guest preacher come in, and that would be a big deal. And so Jesus is now a rabbi, and he is the guest rabbi that comes in on this Saturday to preach in their synagogue. So he went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority, not as the scribes. So two things are going on here. Catch this. One is they're astonished by it. We've never heard anyone teach like this guy before. But two is that there's scribes that are there every week, and he's like a whole lot better than these scribes that we normally listen to. You know, and you could see how that could be a problem, because these guys are trying so hard, and they have a real emphasis on learning the word and teaching people the word and making sure they know the word. And then this guy comes out of nowhere, and people are like, he's amazing. And so if you're one of those regular scribes who's passionate about knowing the word and thinking you're doing a great job, and this guy just comes and blows you out of the water and quickly is going to contradict some of your teaching, you can see how that's a problem for you, like at a professional level, but also at a personal level. You know, when someone comes in and everyone's like, oh, look at that guy. Like my friend Ian came in a couple months ago. You remember Ian? Big 6'4" Irish Catholic guy from Philly came, and he came and preached. And you guys are like, oh, Ian, you're so great, Ian. Why don't you come back next week, Ian? And I'm like, what am I, chopped liver? No, it's not like that. But you can see how it could be like that, right? His teaching is fundamentally different. He teaches as one with authority. And there's a reason for that. I used to have like a handful of quotes up on my wall in my office about preaching. And I've told a number of you this over the years. My favorite quote about preaching comes from a guy named Sam Alberry. He's a preacher. I think he's in Tennessee now or something. But he said, pastors don't finish sermons. Pastors don't finish sermons. You never finish a sermon. He said they abandon them, hoping what is heard is better than what is said. Because you never feel like it's good enough, because you're taking the word of God and somehow trying to dress it up a little bit. Like, I don't even know what I'm doing here, you know? Pastor we mentioned from time to time, the gospel plus safety plus time guy, Ray Ortland, they asked him once, when do you finish your sermon, like during the week? When do you finish? And I'm like, hey, this guy's going to say like Tuesday or something like that, you know? And he's thought about it. He's like, oh, I finish it when I start preaching it. Like, that's when I'm finished with it, because I'm never finished with it, you know? That's what it is to preach. I have the friend in Atlanta. He sent this a couple years ago. This is the sermon prep horse. And so you can see this, that on Monday morning, you have grand visions of what your sermon is going to look like. It's going to be an epic masterpiece of astonishing whatever. And then you get to like Wednesday and you're like, man, I don't know what I'm doing here. And Thursday, and then you're like, whatever, we'll just throw it out there and see what happens. That's what it's like to preach. On a more serious note, I found this quote a couple weeks ago from John Piper. How many of you know who John Piper is? He's a pretty famous pastor. He gave a talk at Urbana that like hundreds, if not thousands of people in my range, credit with like calling them into ministry. Really effective preacher. He said, all genuine preaching is rooted in a feeling of desperation. You wake up Sunday morning and you can smell the smoke of hell on one side and feel the crisp breezes of heaven on the other. You go to your study and you look down at your pitiful sermon manuscript and you kneel down and cry, God, this is so weak. Who do I think I am? What audacity to think that in 3 hours my words will be the odor of death to death and the fragrance of life to life. My God, who is sufficient for these things? That's John Piper, you know? And most pastors that I know are in this realm. This is how we feel about our preaching. And I think it's probably the right way to think about it, with a lot of humility and temerity when it comes to the task that we've been called to. Jesus did not, does not, would not project any of that, right? Jesus didn't just know the word. Jesus was the word. He was there when all the things the words are about took place. He's like, oh yeah, I remember that. That was awesome. You know? Like, he speaks from a different perspective. He made them happen. He knows them intimately, and the audience could tell. You note in this passage, Mark doesn't say what he taught about, only that he taught, and he taught with authority. There's nothing to pick apart, just that his teaching came across as something fundamentally different than they had ever heard before. Authority. And then this happens. Immediately there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit. And the man cried out, what have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. So this guy has an unclean spirit. Demon possession is like a big thing in the Gospels. It was epidemic in Jesus' day. It might be epidemic in our day. We don't know. Like, I was talking to Graham about preaching through Mark a couple months ago, and I'm like, one of the things that I'm trying to figure out is there's so much demon stuff, and like, I'm not exactly sure what to do with it. Like, this is probably a month ago, listened to a couple hours interview with a Catholic priest whose job is to be an exorcist, just to like get in that, to get ready, not for this sermon, but for another sermon coming up, where it ends up being the main topic, you know? And because the stuff is, we'll go through this, but it's real, and you guys know it's real, but we don't know what to do with it. We don't know how prevalent it is, so it's just harder to talk about. For this sermon, what I'll say is I think it's really important not just to write it off and think these people were so dumb, they lived thousands of years ago, they thought everything was a demon, because they didn't. This is from Matthew, and it's, again, the beginning of Jesus' ministry. He went throughout all of Galilee, that northern part, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, healing every disease and every affliction among the people. So his fame spread throughout all Syria, and they brought to him all who were sick, those afflicted by various diseases and pains, those oppressed by demons, those having seizures and paralytics, and he healed them. So they could discern between the sick, the diseased, those having seizures, those who were paralyzed, and those who were being oppressed by demons. They didn't just throw everything into the demon category, right? They could discern the difference. There was something fundamentally different about somebody who had some type of demonic oppression problem. And so we have to be careful not to just think we're smarter because we live later. Like, collectively, we might be smarter, but individually, I bet we might be dumber. You know what I mean? Like, we might be smart in the thing that we're smart at, but dumber in everything else. The comedian Nate Bargatze, he has a great thing about how if he went back in time, he wouldn't be able to change anything about history because he knows so little about it. Has anybody ever heard this? He's like, I could go back and tell him, man, someday you're going to have this thing. It's like a phone, but it's like a block of metal, and you can talk on it, and you can see people, and you can like see the internet. And they'd be like, that's awesome. All right, how do we make that? Let's make that. It'd be like, oh, I don't have any idea. You know, or they'd ask him, like, who's the next president going to be? And he's like, ooh, that's tough. And they'd be like, you're not really from the future, are you? You just dress different. And a lot of us are like that. These people aren't, they're not dumb. They're not dumb and naive. And demon possession is not just in this culture. Like, it's in all the cultures. You can read about it in Chinese culture, in Egyptian culture, in Greek culture. And when it came to demons, there's a whole body of writing on what to do about it. And I didn't know this stuff before. So there's a bunch of rabbinic writings, the rabbis, about what to do. How many of you have seen The Chosen, have watched that? Like, so the very first episode, they're dealing with Mary Magdalene, who had seven demons, according to Scripture. And so some rabbis are going in and trying to cast out these demons, and they're having no luck doing it. And they got incense and that spells, and like, that's a thing. They would, in the name of Solomon or in the name of Isaiah, try and cast out the demon with these long prayers. They would do crazy stuff. They would take, they would hold feces up to the nose of the demon-possessed person to try and convince the demon to go out of them. They would waterboard people. They would pour water over them to try and get the demon to come out of them. They would, I couldn't believe this, there was a practice called trepanning where they would drill holes in people's heads so that the demons could get out. I heard this, and I'm like, no way. So I went down that rabbit hole for like a couple hours, and it was a really interesting rabbit hole if you want to go down there. There's so much stuff about it. And they didn't just do it for demons. They would do it if you had chronic headaches, the pounding in your head. They would think, well, let's cut a hole in your head and see if that like relieves the pressure, you know? And they would do it to let the demon out. And it wasn't just like a little hole. It was like a hole like that big. They have dug up cemeteries and found that it wasn't just a few people that they cut holes in their head. And they lived after they cut the hole in their head because they could tell that the skull grew like after they cut the hole in their head. And so these people are walking around with holes in their head, somehow not getting infected. And if it worked and the demon was cast out, they would take the piece of bone and wear it around their neck. Isn't that crazy? So there's a whole thing with this. And this is the point. Jesus rebuked the demon, saying, be silent and come out of him. And the unclean spirit convulsed the man and crying out with a loud voice and came out of him. So one pastor said, like, amidst all this stuff that they did with demons, the beginning of the Chosen, all that stuff, Jesus says to this demon, and this is how it could be interpreted, shut up and get out. And the demon does it. And the people are like, you remember that rap battle gif? You know what I'm talking about? That's what's happening right here. Like, whoa! Like, who is this guy? Like, this is nuts. It's totally different than anything that they'd seen before. And they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, what is this? A new teaching with authority. He commands the unclean spirits and they obey him. They'd never seen it before. Fundamentally different than what they'd seen before. And at once, his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding region of Galilee. Capernaum's on this major trade route, and news starts to spread. Jesus goes viral. The hard thing for me about preaching this passage, and I think for us about getting it, is that we weren't in the synagogue in Capernaum. We could go to the synagogue in Capernaum, but we're not going to hear Jesus teach the way he taught or see him cast out a demon, right? If he showed up this morning and taught like that, we would see it. We collectively would fire me and hire Jesus and be like, come back next week, Jesus, because it would be so fundamentally different, you know? But we don't have it. And so the question I've been asking is, like, how do we get to a place of being astonished by the authority of Jesus in the way we should be astonished, compelled, moved by the authority of Jesus? Whose authority are we astonished by right now? Yeah, astonished can be read a couple different ways, can it? Like, wow, or like, whoa. So, yeah, we're astonished by Trump's authority right now, or Elon Musk's authority. But let's get beyond that. Whose authority is kind of astonishing? Who has authority? Who are people amazed by today? Pardon me? Bill Gates. Yeah, Billy Graham before he died. He definitely had some authority. Taylor Swift? Somehow. I guess Kendrick Lamar. Like, I didn't know what was going on there, but I read afterwards, people were pretty astonished by what he pulled off at the Super Bowl halftime show. John and I were talking about this earlier. He's like, AI? Facts. Like, it is pretty astonishing what that is. I don't even know where to put it. Like, charismatic people have authority, successful people have authority, popularity begets popularity because we want to be on the winning team, you know, and so that can be authoritative, but like, I don't even know what has authority like this. So I'm going to take what seems like a little bit of a right turn, but I think I'll be right back. I think this will make sense. I put in the weekly email a couple podcasts this week in the spirit of being students of the culture. So I do these a lot. I'm fascinated by this stuff. And so culture, I think, is like a group of people that are in a collective space and a collective time. It's their collective pursuit of happiness and meaning in life ends up shaping what culture is, like what we're after, you know? And so the church, in that time and space, somehow shares that pursuit, but in another way doesn't, because our happiness and our purpose and our meaning comes from what the scriptures tell us about who Jesus is and who we are and how we have a relationship with the Lord. So it's, in some ways, this, like, there's a Venn diagram where they cross, you know, they can't help it, but it's a different thing. But as the church in a culture, we ought to be students of culture and find out, like, what's going on, because we're called to be witnesses of who Jesus is and what he's doing. And you just do that better if you know what's going on in culture. So one of the podcasts I put on had a woman named Barry Weiss. It's the Honestly podcast, interviewing a woman named Louise Perry. So Barry Weiss is a woman. She might be a little bit younger than me. She was raised in a Jewish home. She is... She is married to her female partner. They have a couple kids, you know, so we're not in the same camps of things. I heard her a couple years ago because she had, apparently after the 2016 election, the New York Times hired her because they realized how far left the paper was, and they wanted, like, the editorial board to move a little bit further to the right. Not, they don't want to be on the right, but they realized they were too far on the left, so they hired her because she's kind of centrist, and then they fired her because they didn't like what she was doing. And so it was interesting. And she, when she started this podcast, she started the Free Press. She's part of starting a university in Austin that's really focused on freedom of speech, and I really appreciate that. But she said that her dad taught her that when you should always start from your ideological opponent's best argument and not their worst argument. Does that make sense? You should always start, if you're getting in an ideological disagreement with someone, always start from their, give them the benefit of the doubt. Don't assume that they're stupid or evil, because that's what we do all the time with them, whoever them is. Start from their best argument and not from their worst argument, from a steel man and not a straw man. And I really appreciate that, so I listened to her a bit. She's interviewing Louise Perry, who's a 30-something British woman who wrote a book a couple years ago called The Case Against the Sexual Revolution. And she had kind of evolved on this to the place where a lot of the book has to do with about how casual sex was presented in the sexual revolution as empowering for women, but in reality, it totally disempowers women. And she's like, the wool was pulled over our eyes. This was not a good idea. And so it's totally counterculture. It's British, whatever. And so on the podcast, they start talking about sex, and with some very obvious modifications, they end up talking about how so much of the biblical, traditional Christian sexual ethic is good for culture. And they sound amazed that they're having the conversation, that they're like coming back around after 60 years of the revolution, sexual revolution, and saying, you know what, they didn't have it all wrong. They didn't have it all wrong. Like, pornography is not good for people or culture. Casual sex is not good. Monogamy is good, and marriage is good. We fought the sexual revolution, and we won, but we may have lost in so many ways. And so they kind of make arguments for waiting to have sex and not having casual sex and not watching porn and getting married and many things that would be considered countercultural today. It's an astounding listen. Louise Perry might be a Christian. She is going to church, but she wants to believe, but she can't quite be there. And I would say this, she has been astonished at the teaching of Jesus and compelled by it, because what everybody thought was all wrong, it turns out, might be right. The other podcast was a guy who's more popular than any of them, named Jordan Peterson, who's a Canadian psychologist. He came to public prominence a few years ago, really because of some freedom of speech stuff of his own in Canada, but then just became this public figure, kind of countercultural, wrote a book called 12 Rules for Life that a lot of younger men have gravitated to because they want structure. And now he kind of travels the world speaking to, like, he's going to be at the DPAC in March, I think, and speaks to thousands of people about just kind of whatever he feels like. It's weird, you know? And so he's talking on a podcast, a British guy named, I don't even know his name, The Diary of a CEO. Has anybody ever heard of that? It's the most popular podcast in Britain. I hadn't heard of it till a few weeks ago. Young guy, super successful, again in his 30s. And again, Jordan Peterson, who might be a Christian, but is being pretty coy about it if he is arguing, like, vehemently against pornography, against casual sex, against premarital sex, for marriage and kids, and not using the authority of the Bible, but using his experience and expertise as a psychologist, really, and arguing this on air to a young man who has been living with his girlfriend and is considering wrestling with marriage. And Peterson is just going at him, saying, like, well, here's all the reasons why you're doing the wrong thing and you should be doing something different. And again, Peterson, if you followed him over the years, like, he might be a Christian. It's close. But if you listen to him, it is. He started studying the Bible, and he was astonished by it, and it drew him in. And so they were amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, what is this? A new teaching with authority, something different. And I bring this up because I think we get astonished today by Jesus' teaching when we follow it, even when we're not astonished by it. But then we come to realize he knew what he was talking about. In this one example, these two podcasts really had to do about the sexual revolution. It started 60 years ago, and 60 years ago, the chains came off. And I use this analogy a lot, you know, that the Garden of Eden has the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, where God said, like, you can try and figure it out on your own, which is eating from the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, or you can have a relationship with me, and I'll kind of give you the information you need on an as-needed basis. And you can do that through relationship. And over time, what our culture did when it was a mostly Christian culture is maybe inadvertently put a fence of guilt and shame around that tree so that if people ate of the tree, what kept them wasn't relationship with the Lord, but what kept them was guilt and shame. And that broke down, and that's, I think, why the sexual revolution happened. And that fence came down, and people ran to the tree and started doing whatever they wanted to. And 60 years later, we're realizing, man, the fruit of that tree was not really good for our culture. In a lot of ways, that ended up doing some really, really bad things. And some people in culture are thinking, man, maybe Jesus knew what he was talking about all along. And in a way, are being astonished at the authority of the teaching of Jesus. Will that compel them to follow him? Who knows? It didn't compel all the people in Capernaum to follow him. Like, there's another step to it. But it's a step. They've been amazed by his authority. This reminded me of a scene in the Bible. It's a little bit later. Jesus is, you know, beefing with some of the religious leaders. Like what I said, the tension is building up. And it's almost... Oh, this makes sense. It's almost like these podcasters saying the teaching is amazing is one thing. Saying Jesus is divine, that's another thing. So in the scene, Jesus says to some of the Jews who'd believed him, if you abide in my word and you're truly my disciples, then you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. If you abide in my word, if you're really my disciples, you'll follow what I've told you to do. You'll trust me. And then you'll know the truth and the truth will set you free. There's some level of astonishment that comes after obedience. If you follow me when it doesn't make sense, when it costs you something, when others fall away because it's just too much to believe, then you will know the truth. Then you'll know it. And the truth is going to set you free. Years ago, probably 20 years ago, we're at our old church and I'm doing a lot of premarital classes. And so in that, I'm, you know, telling people, hey, you shouldn't live together before you get married. And a lot of people are coming to the premarital class that are living together. And so I'm like, you guys, we got to figure something out. Because, like, and my old boss said this, well, he said, it's hard for you to expect God to honor your marriage if you're not going to do what he tells you to do. Like, that wouldn't make sense, right, to say, bless my marriage, but I'm not going to trust you, you know? And there's a lot of reasons why I would say biblically you shouldn't live together before you get married. So, but I'm just saying that because you're supposed to say it. And then I read an article in the New York Times. This is almost 20 years ago. It's the first time I'd ever seen it. That said they have statistical data, they'd gotten it at that point, that said if you live together before you get married, you are statistically more likely to get divorced. Which is a way of saying, Jesus was right. Like, this works, you know? And I was astonished, and I'm the one teaching it. And I was like, it caught myself with that, you know? Like, my wife and I didn't live together before we got married. And that was probably obedience, trust, tradition. I was on staff as a pastor, like, it wasn't an option, you know? Like, but we didn't. I don't think we felt like smart, you know, because we had been astonished by some of Jesus' teachings. We felt obedient because we felt like that's what he told us to do. I honestly thought living together before you get married makes sense because my parents have been divorced, and so I was really, really cautious about marriage. And so the logic behind living together before you get married, and I'm not trying to cast shame on anybody who lived together before they get married. But the logic behind it is like, well, if we live together, then we're going to find out how we get along. And if we get along well, then we have a better chance of staying married. And that makes sense. And it made sense to me. But then this article came out and I'm like, well, what is that? And dug into it a little bit. And then the logic behind that makes more sense because the commitment of marriage and becoming one is something totally different than living together, right? You live together for a few months or a few years, and you think, well, all right, we're good. We got it down. But that kind of assumes that nothing's going to change. Like, as long as it stays like this, we're going to be okay. The only thing I can guarantee you about marriage is that things are going to change. Like, the first thing that's going to change is you got married. And marriage is something completely different than you've ever done before, right? It's going to change you because it's such a massive commitment. And, like, you've committed. You're stuck. You're in. You're there. the cost of leaving is a lot greater now. I was listening to the Men Are From Mars guy a few weeks ago, and he was talking about how when you're married, you're so, like, he was talking about criticism within marriage. Not that anybody ever has criticism within their marriage, you know, but like he's talking about how when your spouse critiques you, like has some type of criticism, you take it so much more personally. Can I get an amen? Because that person knows you so well. They know everything about you. You're totally exposed. And so when they critique something about you, which they are going to with good reason, right? You just take it harder than you would a coworker or even like another family member, because you're not as tied up with them. Because the opinion of your spouse about, like their opinion about you defines you in ways that nobody else's opinion about you defines you, you know? And so that just changes, and life is going to change, and kids are going to change you, and you're going to get fired from your job, and you're going to move, and your parents are going to die, and everything will change, and you change too. And so marriage isn't a statement of, well, we've lived together for a little while, so as long as it's like this, we're going to be good. It's a statement of, yeah, everything is going to change, but I'm with you, and you're with me through hell or high water, and likely both. And that requires a lot of faith that God is going to be at work within that. And in those hard times, working on you in ways that you didn't want to be worked on. And over time and over time and over time, you can see the ways that that's happened. And that joins you together in ways that you never imagined that it could, right? But it's a totally different way of looking at it. And it's not an intuitive way of looking at it. It's a counterintuitive way of looking at it. And I thought, reading this article, that's exactly it. And I was astonished at his teaching. And honestly, a little embarrassed. I don't know that I didn't trust him more when I did it. That I was astonished. That I didn't expect to be astonished, you know? But I think that's how we grow astonished by the teaching of Jesus. C.S. Lewis has a quote where he says, "I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. Because the more you follow Christ and the more you trust in his word, the more sense it makes of everything that's going on around you." The first three books of Genesis read me and us like a book. They read us like a book, and it was written 3,500 years ago. It was recorded to a culture that is nothing like ours. And it nails us, and it astonishes me more and more every time I go through it. They were astonished at the teaching of Jesus, and we should be too. And if we're not, if we've lost that astonishment, it might be because we've settled into some place where we're comfortable. And we haven't gone further in things that he's taught us that don't make a lot of sense to us, the places that we don't really want to go, risks that we don't really want to take. Because that seems to be the path by which he continues to astonish. And that process takes longer than listening to him for a few hours in the synagogue, you know? Even with this, like the Jordan Peterson saga, he wasn't saying this stuff 20 years ago. 10 years ago, you could listen to him, and he's like, just kind of like, whoa, maybe. And you can kind of track his astonishment and how it's compelled him and where it's led him. Now, remember my question way back at the beginning about whether or not the exile worked for the Jewish people. Whether when God sent them to exile, that did something that impacted them in a way. And the Jewish people experienced the consequences of their failure to trust God, which was the exile. So they rededicated themselves, to his words. This is a little bit like that in our day. Like these years of the sexual revolution have been a bit of exile, a suffering of consequences. And we could talk about that. Not all of it was bad, but like a lot of it was. We could talk about that forever, right? Will anyone learn a lesson and rededicate themselves, not just to the wisdom of the Lord, but to the Lord? Right? It's the Garden of Eden. It's either we take from that tree and we figure it out for ourselves, or we trust the Lord and we grow in relationship with the Lord, because the only way we know the knowledge of good and evil is by following Jesus. And then he will astonish. Will our exiles pay off? Will your exiles pay off? The times when you've experienced the consequences of failing to follow God and thought, man, he was right, will it drive you back to Jesus. If you want to be astonished by his teaching, abide in his word. Abide in his word patiently, maybe frustratingly at times, maybe a bit confused, but faithfully. And over time, you'll come to know and understand in deeper ways that he is the Holy One of God. In the other scene I referenced, where he says, if you're really my disciples, you follow my commandments, then you'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Here's what comes right after that. They answered him, we are offspring of Abraham, and we've never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free? And Jesus answered them, truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. Everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed. Our problem isn't knowledge. We don't need to understand the rules better. We don't need words. We need the one who is the word, who was in the beginning. We need to be astonished, not just at the teaching of Jesus, but at Jesus. And the Jewish people, after the exile, had one thing right? They'd screwed everything up, and God was still going to come rescue them. And some of them got it, and some of them didn't, and we're no different. We needed a rescue, and Jesus is the one that has come to rescue. Father, thanks for these scenes. Thanks that these places were real places, and these people were real people, and that you came and you changed them, Lord, that you astonished them. For a lot of us in this room, there was a day when we were totally astonished by you. And sometimes that wears off, Lord. And sometimes it's probably okay that it wears off. But for some of us, it's worn off for way too long. Would you call us to follow you in new places, to trust you in new ways, to be astonished at the work that you're doing in the world around us, Lord? And to long for you. And Lord, I pray for anybody who is in here that it's a different thing. Like, we all naturally think our problem is that we didn't follow the rules, and that is our problem. Our problem is that we couldn't follow the rules, and we can't fix that problem. Only you can fix that problem. And so for those who haven't realized, Jesus isn't just a good teacher who came to explain some rules to us. He is the one who came to follow the rules in our place, to die to pay the consequences for our sins, to give us his righteousness and take our unrighteousness, to do something for us we could never do for ourselves. It's not about doing. It's about believing in the good news of the gospel and repenting and following Jesus. And Father, only you can bring us to that place, and I pray that you would bring them to that place. Lord, we love you and pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.